It is 8:30, and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. And we have in the studio with us once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. How are you both this morning? John's ready to crack up.
I just had this hunch that you were going to ask that question, that's all.
Uh-huh. Do you have an answer?
No.
Okay.
I'm still thinking about that one.
doing fine, thank you. Going to go running off to Rolling Thunder this morning for the better part of the day at some godforsaken park three time zones away in Renton. But
announce it now.
Yes, we'll talk about that, I guess, later in the program after people have their pencils and papers ready.
They should already have those ready.
Oh, okay. Well,
sharpened.
They didn't put them down from Counterspin.
I hope not.
Oh, okay.
I'm hoping they still have ink or lead or whatever in them. So let's get rolling. I was sorry that I had missed our very own president of the United States, who was in Portland this week. Did either of you get a chance to catch him?
No.
No, I was not down there, which is a good thing because my eyes water easily when, you know, I'm pepper sprayed. Had an interesting conversation yesterday, though, with a reporter at Seattle Weekly who's a, you know, pretty mainstream kind of guy who came up from he used to work at a paper in Portland until a few months ago and is now up here. But he was talking with folks down in Portland, and these are, you know, not protesters necessarily, so it's not the usual, oh, we had thousands of people and we kicked the police's ass and they were brutal and yada yada. This is a, you know, fairly mainstream account of what happened.
Which he was talking to, like, reporter friends. And
yeah, exactly. And he was giving me a very different account of what happened on Thursday when Bush is in Portland than the AP Wire stories that wound up showing up in the papers here in Seattle. For one, he pegged it at a couple thousand demonstrators, at least half of whom were environmental crowd rather than the hundreds that were reported in the Seattle papers. And he basically called it a police riot. But above and beyond that, and of course they have a long tradition at this point of police riots in Portland, particularly against demonstrators of various types, and it's been a big local issue down there in the past, unlike Seattle. But he was saying in particular that this wasn't the local police chief's call this time. This was the Secret Service. This was the people surrounding George Bush saying, well, we want a little bit more of a cordon around the hotel where Bush is. And so the police had no choice, basically, but to push the crowd back in a, you know, the caring and gentle way that police often do. And some people didn't like, you know, the way they used their clubs or whatever. And at that point, you know, the police riot broke out. And it's a big deal down there. But it's also a reminder that the people surrounding the imperial presidency of the United States really aren't particularly anxious to have the president actually see the rabble that was out there. Apparently, one of the other things that was concerning the Secret Service was that the local police neglected to leave a way in for the various distinguished guests that were going to be meeting with the president.
That was very important because Bush is on a tour doing enormous fundraisers for Republican candidates, you know, million-dollar dinners.
Not only million-dollar dinners, but million-dollar dinners with the types of donations that will be illegal next month. So it's very important that he press the flesh and close the deal on some of those donations this month.
Right, and that those people get through and be able to actually sit and listen to him speak and then write the big checks afterwards.
Yeah, so that's basically what it was about, that a couple thousand of our friends down in Portland were tear-gassed and pepper-sprayed and beat upon by the local cops because Bush wanted to raise a little bit of extra money, which is, you know, how our democracy works these days.
Yeah, and while he was down there, he's been doing this tour through Oregon and California to raise money for various Republican candidates who are going to be running for office in Oregon and California. But while he's doing it, he's been giving a speech on loosening logging rules in the national forests. He's addressing a topic that he thinks is a big deal for Western states, and it is a big deal. The recent wildfires in Western states have been pretty devastating. However, his response to the wildfires is to begin doing much more thinning on the national forest land. Now, anybody
to create bigger fires.
Right. Now, anybody who's been following the logging policy for the last couple of decades knows that what thinning means, and thinning means taking out the biggest trees from our national forests. Those are the most commercially viable trees for commercial logging companies to take and to sell. They can get a much, much higher price for large trees. They also have to do a minimum work to get a lot of money by taking the largest trees. But what that does is that makes our forests a huge tinder pot for wildfires.
Yeah, and now, when we talk about minimum work, bear in mind also they're not clearing the scrub underneath these trees once they do the cutting, and that is really where a lot of the fuel for a lot of these trees comes from, instead of the big trees, which are the most fire resistant in the course of a big fire.
Now, you don't have to believe me. You can go hiking in our national forests and national parkland and see the difference. I was over in the Olympic Peninsula this week on my vacation doing a little bit of hiking. Now, if you go hiking over there, it's one place in the country where you can see national forest land right next to a national park where logging is not allowed, and you can see how our forests have been managed all these years. you can actually see the park divide if you fly over, or if you hike through it, you can see the park divide. You go from national forest land, which is basically a collection of toothpick trees, all small, all the same size.
Or clear cuts.
Right, or clear cuts. You see lots of light or filtered light, and you see a huge mess of underbrush. It's just choking underbrush, and it's a very, very dry place right now because we've had pretty much a drought for us. Now, when you cross the boundary into the national parkland, what you see is old growth trees, very, very tall, or you see mature forests, very big trees. You see very little light, lots of shade. You see almost no underbrush. You see very damp ground. And that's why old growth trees are really a barrier for wildfires. But it's been the policy of the Clinton administration and of the current administration to not allow thinning, which would take out small trees, but to allow thinning that would take out large and commercially viable trees in our national. And they've really created the problem. Plus, it's also interesting to note that the Pacific Biodiversity Institute in Winthrop, Washington, has done a study of they've analyzed wildfires over the last decade. And what they came up with was a conclusion that less than 20% of burned land was national forest land. The rest was private land, tribal land, or other types of public land. Much of that was grassland or shrubland, which adds some evidence to that assertion that it's really old growth that stops fires and that we should be preserving on our national forests.
I think under the current administration, isn't it all shrubland now? Sea to shining sea.
That's probably what Bush really, really is aiming for.
And I'm sure on his personal map, it's written that way. All right, anything else on that?
Or no, we can move on.
Move on to, there was a FISA ruling this week, a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act ruling.
Yes. No, it wasn't the act itself, though, that was ruling. The act itself is an act that was passed a number of years ago that governs how the federal government can present information against terror suspects. And there's a secret tribunal, essentially, a secret, I believe, three-person judge panel that rules over whether these are being done properly and considers individual cases to see whether the federal government can go ahead and screw with these people. And there was a remarkable ruling this week, remarkable in two senses. Number one, that it was even released and made public at all, because this panel, like much of our open and widely available and accessible public government, exists in almost complete secrecy. You never hear about the actual rulings. And then the content of the ruling was also remarkable. What it basically said, it was actually an opinion from last May. Shows you how long it took for it to get probably leaked into the press.
No, actually, they did release it.
They did release it on their own?
Unprecedented. Yeah, they haven't released a ruling for 20 years.
Yeah, but
to the public.
Basically, what the ruling claims is that there were, I'm trying to look for the exact number, I believe it was 75?
75
different court cases that the federal government has managed over the past few years, in which basically it lied to this panel about the nature of the defendants, about the nature of their crimes, about the nature of the the evidence that it had against them. And then what it was saying basically was the Department of Justice under Ashcroft is now coming to them asking for even broader powers, and they're saying no, the federal government, and this goes into administrations prior to John Ashcroft as well as the current administration, has been abusing the power that it already has, let alone that it should be endowed with even greater powers. It was a remarkable ruling.
Right, and you have to understand that the cases that come before this court are applications for warrants to do wiretaps and other kinds of surveillance on suspects. The court has always tried to maintain a strong line between surveillance for national security reasons and surveillance for criminal reasons. The court doesn't want to grant any warrants to do surveillance on anyone under a criminal investigation because it would violate people's privacy rights.
Yeah.
And that's been spelled out very strongly by the Supreme Court and by the Constitution to protect our privacy rights. We're not criminal justice groups are not allowed to do just random wiretaps. And there's always been that concern that this court could grant wiretaps for those reasons and violate people's privacy rights. And what they found is that many of these 75 errors that the FBI made had to do with that specifically, that a lot of the people they wanted to get surveillance warrants on were people under criminal investigations, and that they then took that information and shared it with police departments and
federal prosecutors
prosecutors and so forth. And so the FBI has been directly crossing that line illegally and abusing that system.
Yeah. Now, bear in mind a couple of things here. Number one is that those wiretaps, the FBI doesn't have to go to those great lengths to get the wiretaps authorized anymore, because under the USA Patriot Act and subsequent regulations, they have much broader powers to just go and wiretap for any criminal investigation or, whatever particular reason they want. The other thing is that
what the court is objecting to is the rules under the USA Patriot Act that the Ashcroft Department of Justice has drafted, saying that we have these expanded wire power.
Yeah.
These wiretap powers.
The other thing that's been very, very interesting, and we'll get into this in a minute with South America, the Bush administration has been doing a rather interesting job of going back and forth across the line between when it wants to consider suspects as terrorists and when it simply wants to consider people for a criminal investigation. When it is trying to wiretap and whatnot, then criminals suddenly become terrorists. On the other hand, when people who it is otherwise considering terrorists, when that's inconvenient, they become criminals. So that when the Bush administration has been pressed recently on its plans in Colombia, and I'll talk a little bit more about Colombia in a minute, but they've been very open in the South American media about the Bush administration really wanting to funnel a lot of arms into Colombia to help the government there in its counterinsurgency against the guerrillas in their long-standing war, there have been a lot of expectations, which we'll talk about in a minute, that it will expand. They've been very open down south about this will be an expanded war. However, if you ask the State Department or if you ask the Bush administration what this is about, no, it's not a counterinsurgency at all. These aren't even terrorists at all. What we're concerned, this is a criminal investigation, because these FARC and so forth, they run drugs. And you see, just because they wear army fatigues doesn't mean they aren't common criminals. So all we're doing is going after common criminals. That's all this is about. So they're playing really hard and loose with
manipulating that boundary,
the rules around that particular boundary for their own purposes.
And we saw that with 9/11 and some of the combatants captured in Afghanistan, that the administration wants to be able to say when someone is a criminal and when they're a terrorist,
or an unlawful
combatant. They want to be able to just do whatever they want. They don't want to be held down by definitions or or by
laws.
And they've been playing fast and loose with that boundary.
Not that they ever
all
even
along.
Give us definitions, and that it's that also applies to the whole suspects with the anthrax cases. We're calling them criminals. Right from the start, and not terrorists.
But definitely not terrorists.
Heaven forbid.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it'd be interesting, too, to note if they pegged 75 of those cases, I'd kind of like to know 75 out of how many.
You
know?
Yeah.
I mean, what's the other number there?
We can't know.
We don't know.
Because it's a secret court. And that's another thing about this issue is that that court is totally secret, and you could argue that that is itself not constitutional, to have a secret court where where these applications are not subject to public review, and people are basically being allowed to be spied on, although there's no evidence that they have done any criminal activity.
Yeah, and not to beat up too much on the Bush administration, because every administration in Washington, D.C. since the beginning of the Cold War has abused the judicial process by invoking national security. And this has gone on for 60 years, and it continues to go on to this day. And the war on terror, of course, has vastly expanded that, once again.
All right. Well, speaking of keeping things from us, there was some recent declassified
documents. That doesn't narrow things down much at all.
I know. Well, if you give me a chance to finish. Some declassified documents were released this week relating to Argentina.
Right. There's been a group of people in Argentina, human rights groups, and friends and families of victims of the military dictatorship in Argentina from 1975 to 1984 that have been suing to get documents released by the U.S. State Department relating to U.S. support for the military junta in Argentina of the time. During those years, the military junta sponsored paramilitary groups that massacred leftists, activists, labor organizers, human rights workers, a number of people that disagreed with the military junta's right-wing agenda. They even massacred several U.S. citizens, too. And during that time, the U.S. ambassador to Argentina was scolding the Argentine government and saying, you know, these are human rights abuses. You can't do this. This is horrible. Maybe you can arrest these people and try them in courts. Maybe you can throw them in prison, but you can't just murder them. You know, you got to clamp down on these paramilitary groups, et cetera, et cetera. However, these newly released documents from the State Department, released because of a lawsuit brought by the friends and family of the victims and various human rights groups in Argentina, these documents show that when – there's actually two that are at issue. They show that when the Argentine foreign minister went to Washington, D.C. to visit the Ford administration, which was the government that was in power here at the time – and to meet in particular with Henry Kissinger to talk about human rights in Argentina, the message they got from Henry Kissinger was, oh, you guys are doing a great job. Make sure you clamp down on these people as quickly as possible. So here was the Ford administration, and in particular Henry Kissinger, giving support to the Argentine military junta to massacre its own political opponents, and even people who were not necessarily political opponents, but just fighting for economic rights or labor rights or doing basic human rights work.
Yeah, the ability to not live in a totalitarian, military dictatorship.
I mean, right.
Very basic stuff.
Right. And so we need to remember when these things are released exactly why the U.S. government doesn't want an international criminal court to be set up, because it's not just our U.S. soldiers in peacekeeping efforts around the world who would be subject to it. If friends and families of victims in Argentina from 1975 to 1984 can sue the ex-Argentine military dictators, then perhaps they might want to also sue someone like Henry Kissinger or other top Ford administration officials.
Who, as people may or may not remember, on September 10th last year, the day before the World Trade Center bombings, Henry Kissinger had a suit brought against him by survivors of the Chilean dictatorship, roughly the same time period under Pinochet. And this, of course, was the same period of time in which the Indonesian invaded East Timor with Ford and Kissinger's blessing. Mm-hmm. And this isn't just Henry Kissinger, of course, either. You've had this remarkably interesting schism in a couple different ways around whether to invade Iraq at the moment. And part of it has been the definition of how bad is Saddam Hussein. And it was very interesting hearing, I think it was Bill Kristol, one of these conservative commentators, defending the, I believe it was the Bush senior administration at the time. No, it was the Reagan administration, I'm sorry. In 1987, when Saddam Hussein was first suspected of mass use of chemical weapons in the Iran-Iraq war, and the United States States was selling a great number of weapons to Saddam Hussein at the time because we consider Iran the greater threat, and we really wanted the two sides to just kill each other off so that we can take both of their oil. But so they're saying, oh, yes, the U.S. lodged great protests when this happened. Well, technically it did, yes. Jean Kirkpatrick went to the United Nations and said, we are very concerned about this, yada, yada. But at the very same time, literally the same day that this information was made public, who from the Reagan administration was in Baghdad itself, but the United States ambassador for Middle East affairs, closing an arms sale deal to
Saddam Hussein's government,
and not saying a word at all about the revelations that were all over the news in that particular day. That man's name was Donald Rumsfeld. And so here you have Donald Rumsfeld, the guy who is now deciding whether to invade Iraq and very much would like to, who is the man who was in Baghdad shaking hands with Saddam Hussein at the very day that the revelations came out that this guy was using weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons.
And you could say, you know, maybe the Reagan administration just didn't know at that point, and later they could have done something about it. However, this week, I'm glad that you mentioned this, Job, because this week there were also revelations that, and this is something we probably could have suspected, there were revelations that even after the Reagan administration knew that Iraq had used gas against the Kurds, that they continued a secret operation to provide support, and not just weapons to Saddam Hussein, but intelligence on the battlefield to help him plan his battles, etc. There was a lot of help that the Reagan administration provided after the Kurds were gassed. They did not even threaten to withhold any of this help.
Yeah, and so you have this remarkable dynamic where the big debate over whether to invade Iraq right now is between Donald Rumsfeld and Henry Kissinger. And it's like these two men should both, you know, be in front of an international war crimes tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
I read some reports that at the time we were given information, technical information to Iraq, that we were actually giving some to Iran at the same time. We were actually, like, supplying both sides with information.
We were certainly playing each side off against the other. Mm-hmm. I don't know about the battlefield information. That may have just been the for the Iraqis. But at the same time, we were definitely, through third parties, selling arms to both sides, for example. And it was very much a policy of why don't you and he fight?
And we could say, you know, you could say, oh, that was in the past. That stuff isn't going on now. But in fact, it is going on now. This week also, our favorite military dictator in Pakistan, General Pervez Musharraf, just unilaterally rewrote his country's constitution to give himself veto powers over every single executive, every single branch of the government, from parliament to the executive branch to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, well,
so
we're still supporting
dictators.
Yeah, this is General Musharraf. He gave himself the title of president about a year and a half ago in order to look better, and of course that was obsequiously
staged an election in which he was the only candidate, and there were several many irregularities, so that now nearly everyone in Pakistan believes it was rigged.
Yeah, and this type of election is exactly the type that the American government has criticized in countries that it doesn't like as being a sham election. But when it's done by one of our trusted allies and good friends, even if it's that same country whose militants literally attacked and tried to blow up India's parliament building not too long ago, they buy our weapons, they do what we tell them to on the battlefield, they're our allies.
Well, speaking of buying our weapons, there's a tie to that with Colombia that you wanted to talk about briefly.
There's a couple different things. In Colombia, it's an interesting dynamic because when José Uribe, a very right-wing third-party candidate, was elected to the presidency about a month and a half ago, that was widely anticipated to signal a marked escalation in the civil war there. He campaigned on the platform of, we're going to wipe out all of these guerrillas that are threatening our cities. We're going to increase the offensive against them, and we're going to be working side by side with the Pentagon in doing this. And the Bush administration obviously was cheerleading for this. They went and offered their congratulations to him even before the votes were counted on the evening of the of the election. And then an odd thing happened during his election night victory speech. He said, I want talks with both the paramilitaries and the leftist guerrillas, FARC and the other various groups that
peace
were involved.
Talks.
Peace talks. And then about a week after that, lo and behold, a poll comes out, which is a fairly unusual thing in Colombia, actually, and it also skews to the middle and upper classes because those are the people who have telephones. A poll comes out saying that Uribe was elected not because people wanted the war escalated. In fact, only about a quarter of those surveyed wanted the war escalated, and only about 12% of those surveyed wanted help from foreign powers in escalating that war. So he has this real mandate at this point and is pursuing the opportunity to try and set up peace talks, try and set up negotiations between the government and the paramilitaries and the leftist rebels. And the one party that isn't particularly cooperative in all this because they don't want to see any of this happen is the Bush administration. They're actually quite anxious to be able to go in full feet first, not have to pretend that it's a counter-narcotics insurgency, and be able to give direct military aid for all this stuff. Very, very scary stuff.
All right. Only have a couple minutes left, and real briefly, there was just jumping back to local stuff. King County Council apparently is doing a shell game with
money. They're busy drafting the regional transportation plan. Pierce County and Snohomish County know exactly what they want. They're all done. It's the King County Council that's been lagging behind, and the reason why the plan is going to go to the May ballot rather than the November ballot. Well, the tussle has been over funding for transit. There's been about $1 billion to $1.5 billion that Dwight Pels says is not quite enough. Well, actually, it's much less than that going to transit, but he's asked for more. What the King County Council did is they finally got Pels in their corner, and they have actually dropped all money for transit out of the regional transportation package, every single dime. And you know where it's gone? It's gone to the viaduct. So now the Alaskan...
The most expensive option of the
viaduct.
Yeah,
the most expensive option for replacing the viaduct. And now that option, which is going to cost $11 billion, has $3 billion from the regional transportation package is going to go to that option, leaving it still, you know, if you include the half a billion to $1 billion out of Referendum 51, the state package is still going to be short about $7 to $8 billion.
Mm-hmm. And that's without some of like Hyman's stuff passing, which is likely to happen in the next couple of elections.
Right, which could cut the knees out from under any of this.
The likely cost increases.
And we also have to remember that this regional package will only be on the ballot and be able to pass if Referendum 51 passes in November, and that's not looking very likely at the moment.
All right. Real quickly, tell us about Rolling Thunder. Are you guys going to be there?
We will.
We are.
Both of us and many other people besides. Rolling Thunder is this sort of rolling carnival, festival, workshop, speakers, music, bands, all kinds of different things. It's been going from city to city. It is the brainchild of former Texas Agriculture Commissioner and heck raiser Jim Hightower. Been in, I think, four or five cities up until now. I think Seattle was the fourth. The last place they were was Tucson in the middle of July, so this has to be an improvement. It's going on in Petrovsky Park in the very eastern wilds of Renton.
Petrovsky Park.
Sorry, I can tell you how fun I've been there.
Oh, it was Russian names.
But there is a shuttle going from Seattle, and I don't know how much of a capacity these shuttles will have. I heard that it was going to be a van and going once every 2 hours, so they're likely to have more demand than they are capacity.
So try to call your friends and carpool.
Yeah, call your friends and carpool. The information on the event is at www.rollingthunder.org. The van pool
itself... Rollingthundertour.org.
Sorry, you're right.
Is there a phone number that people can call?
Well, the van pool itself, just to let people know, leaves from 2nd and Jackson, I think it is.
2nd and Union.
2nd and Union, I'm sorry. Then it stops at 3rd and Jackson.
No,
that's the deal.
It starts at 2nd and Union, goes to 4th Avenue South and South Jackson, and 23rd Avenue South and South Jackson,
right,
and some other stops.
In any event. So, there's got to be a phone number here somewhere, too. Do you see one?
I don't see one on
all
this.
All right.
Well, people get the idea. They should get down there.
Petrovitsky Park. It goes all day, 10 to 10. And,
exactly.
Petrovitsky Park is, the address is 16400 Southeast Petrovitsky Road. It's in Renton.
All right. Yeah. With that, we are unfortunately out of time and don't really have the time for a full description of Eat the State, perhaps just your contact info real quick.
By the way, MapQuest works great for that, too.
Actually, I don't think MapQuest is working too well anymore. I think they lost their funding.
Too bad. Well, for Eat the State, if you want more information or can give tips or whatever, give us a call. The number 206-903-9461 or stop by and see us at Rolling Thunder.